Welcome once again to our podcast. This is the Connect and Grow with Dr. Bill podcast, and I'm Bill Pubels here at the Biblical Studies Center. This is a place to connect with God, people, and ideas. And we have a people today, a person, Billy Mogensen. Billy is with Crew here at Boise State and has been for years. I'll let you tell me how many. You were a student here, and you were an intern when we arrived, I think, in 2004. Yeah. Is that right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
You've always been staff to me. Like, you've always been the leader. And so
I was a student when you first visited,
Really? Okay.
I think I was in my senior year. Was it 2004?
2004, we got here that summer, and I did come and do a spring event for the football team in 2003.
That's what I remember. You visited, you were in my living room, and I was in my last semester as a senior. Yeah, so I transferred to Boise State as a junior in 2001.
That's from where?
College of Southern Idaho.
Okay.
Twin Falls.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
So studying engineering and then got involved with Crew here. So, yeah, 20 years at Boise State.
That's amazing.
Crew. Yeah. Yeah.
I can't believe, you know, I feel older and older because
right.
I remember my dad used to say something. I've had that ski jacket for 20 years. I'm like, that's not something to brag about. Dad.
Right.
You know, well, now I've got socks older than that, I think.
Yep. I understand.
Crazy.
I just told my own kids that. I got some golf shoes. Mine are like 25 years old. Like, God, Dad, you're... Those are old.
Those are old. Were they in black and white back then?
Right.
Yeah. So, well, it is really fun to have you. You and I half jokingly tell you that you're like the top campus minister in North America.
Oh my goodness!
Because I really do believe that you have a lot of great qualities, and I look to you a lot of times. In fact, in my mind, when I'm not good at something, I look at someone who's good at that, and I kind of put my "what would they do" bracelet on. It's like, what would Billy do? How would he do this? But it's hard when I just don't have you have the technical ability with computers and stuff that I just am always kind of a learner beginner with. And you're like, oh, here's how you do that. Here's how you do that. I'm like, yeah, what would Billy do? Well, let's just get Billy to do it.
Wow. Well, sheesh. And you know how I react every time you say that. I'm like, God, don't tell people that. Now here it is recorded.
Right.
So very humbled and appreciate that. I disagree. I know lots of other people way more.
Well, at any rate, you've been a faithful minister of the word and campus minister here at Boise State for all these years. And you are, you started as an intern and then you came on. In fact, I had the privilege of having you and Angie in my Bible study methods group when you joined staff. It was back in Florida at
Daytona Beach.
Yeah, Daytona Beach.
Yeah.
And
El Carib.
El Carib. Yeah.
The have, hotel.
Crew owns a hotel there that's actually pretty cool. But, and something specific about that, I just mentioned it to you earlier, but we had a memory of that year. Do you remember what year that was?
I'm thinking it was 2005, like in January.
It was in January, yeah.
It was that or 06, yeah.
Okay. Well, they had the rocket launch to Pluto down at Cape Canaveral.
Yeah.
Cape Canaveral, right?
Yeah.
And I borrowed a van, and a bunch of us went down there, and we stood around for about an hour and a half.
Yeah.
And the wind was just over... So we didn't get to witness the launch up close.
Such a bummer.
I know. It's like it was going to be all time.
Yeah.
So we had to come back. Well, it was a Sunday. And so the next day, Monday, they did end up launching it.
Yeah.
And I remember seeing it from, it was over the beach. Yep. And that was amazing.
It was,
I actually got it on my little digital eight video. Video recorder.
Very cool. Usually just on a screen. So to see it. In person, even from a distance.
It was something.
Yeah.
We had you and Angie and really fun. You guys did I just remember you doing a fantastic job. In fact, to this day, I would say I've never had anyone as thorough as Angie. I mean, she was so thorough. I wanted to say, you know, just realize, but she got an A++ in that in that course.
She reminds me. Yeah. She's like, you know, I got a better grade than you.
Yeah, right. Yeah, yeah. You just probably got an A or an A+.
Yeah. Bill said I was his best student.
She was phenomenal. Yeah. So, but you guys are both phenomenal, and you've got 4 kids.
Yes.
And what are their?
Yeah. So Parker is 12, yeah. 12 and a half. He's going into 7th grade, so I have a junior higher.
Wow.
Crazy. Cooper is about to turn 11, and Addison is 9, and Jackson is 5 and a half, almost 6.
Yeah.
So, yeah, we're kind of in the sweet spot now.
It's a fun.
For the first while, they were all close together. We had 3 kids age 3 and under, and that was something else.
Yeah.
I was kind of drowning then, but
I remember you at some point in there saying, you know, I used to stifle a little bit of judgmentalism, and some of these dads would show up late to a staff meeting, yeah. And, like, and all of a sudden you go, I think I get it now.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Life is a little more full and complex. Yeah. But now, the ages they're at, they can go to the bathroom on their own. It's amazing. They can buckle their own seat belts. It's like, wow, we can actually do some stuff here.
So, that's right.
Yeah.
You've got it made.
Hey.
Wow.
It's a pretty cool time. Yep.
That's awesome. And you guys actually live out kind of in the – is it actually Eagle where you live now?
We're right in the corner of Boise. So
yeah,
Boise,
okay. Drive.
Boise, Eagle, and Meridian. We're like right in that little corner there.
So you can – you can be a part of all those neighborhood associations.
Yes, exactly.
That's great.
Yeah.
So you grew up, I want to hear a little bit more of your story.
Sure.
I've heard it before, mm-hmm. but I know there's things I haven't heard and mm-hmm. there's things that I'd love to hear again. But you grew up in a Christian home in Twin Falls.
Yep.
And what was it like for you, you know, just growing up, and how did you experience the church,
mm-hmm.
your thoughts of God, and was there a time that things changed? Tell me about that.
Yeah. Yeah. I think as a kid, you just kind of think whatever you're experiencing is just normal, what everyone experiences. And I did, but learned later in life really just how good I had it because my parents had a good marriage. I enjoyed my, involvement in church. I actually saw it lived out pretty consistently at home. So that was the environment I grew up in. My mom was the church secretary, so I tell people I literally grew up in church. Like, I'd go there after school.
And oh, really?
On the bus to the church. And
the bus would drop you off at the church?
Yeah, yeah, because my mom was working there.
Wow.
That was, earlier elementary age. My dad was a deacon and a sound guy, and so we just were very, very involved. That's where my friends were, and I enjoyed it. I really did. 2 younger sisters, Carrie and Katie, and we just had a great time growing up. We'd go camping. My dad and I'd go ride dirt bikes. We would just... kind of a lot of my fond childhood memories are the stage of life my kids are in now, which is why I'm like, man, I just want to maximize that because that was such a key part of my own childhood. I was thankfully exposed to the basics of the Bible at an early age. I mean, I was in church and Sunday school from birth, basically.
Yeah, yeah.
Learned that God loved me, sent Jesus, died on the cross, paid the penalty for my sins, rose from the dead. I remember at probably age 3 or 4, like I could at least say that. Now, how much did I understand it? Not very much, but I just knew, man, that I believe that. I remember sitting in the mall parking lot in our Chevy Blazer with my mom, and I can't remember the age. She says I was probably about 5, I think. And I just told her out of the blue, like, hey, I want to pray to receive Jesus. And she's like, okay. And we prayed right there. And as sincere as a little kid can be, I was sincere. Mm-hmm. And as long as I can remember, always wanted to know God more. And so obviously there's ups and downs with that, but I just feel pretty blessed to have never had a time where I really strayed from God or doubted him. I think the time it was tested the most is when I was 15 and my youngest sister Katie drowned in a kiddie pool.
Mm-hmm. She was how old?
She was almost 8.
Yeah.
Almost 8. Yeah. And so that definitely was the most tragic thing I'd ever experienced.
Yeah.
It had been pretty smooth sailing. I had seen hard stuff with other people, but
do you remember that day?
Oh yeah, absolutely.
You're 15. Were you at school or what happened?
It was summer. It was August, so it was almost exactly this time of year that we're recording this. So it was a few days before football practice was going to start. So it was just summer, the end of summer. Yeah, I woke up, came upstairs, was just getting ready in the bathroom, and my mom came in, and I just was frantic about something, and I immediately knew something was terribly wrong. I'd never, ever seen her like that in my life. All I could get out of it, she was pointing to the backyard and saying, "Katie." So I just ran out there, and Katie was on the ground in the grass next to the kiddie pool. My dad was doing CPR on her.
Oh, my word.
He had been an EMT, so he knew what to do, but, and she had epilepsy. So I knew right away what had likely happened. She had a seizure.
In the pool.
Yeah. Oh, I mean, there's only like 4 inches of water in there, but she had a seizure and just couldn't come out of it, sucked water in. And so then my sister had gone and called 911, and then my dad sent me out front to get the paramedics to bring them into the backyard. So the police came. I actually knew one of the officers. He had been like a DARE officer for sixth grade, but yeah, it was just a surreal moment. I mean, because he recognized me. He looked at me and just, a very sober, sad look of compassion, because he could see what we were going through.
Yeah.
Paramedics came and then, we're trying to resuscitate her. Wasn't working. We huddled up as a family to pray. Wow. And I still remember thinking, she'll be fine. Like, of course she'll be fine, because everything's always fine.
Things work out.
Things always work out.
Yeah.
And that was just my assumption. I was like, yeah, and God will hear our prayers, and she'll be fine. We'll go to the hospital. I mean, she's gone through so much already with her epilepsy and everything she's been through in my family that she'll be fine. Yeah. But my mom rode with her in the ambulance, and my dad and I and my sister jumped in the truck. And it really hit me when my pastor came flying down our street just as we were pulling out, and he asked my dad, "How is she?" And my dad said, "She's gone. She's gone." And it just hit me like a punch in the gut. It was just like, oh my gosh, this is real. This is not good. And, got to the hospital, and from then on, I was like, this is like a movie. This is what you see in the movies. We're in it wasn't the main waiting room. They bring you in this other little private waiting room, which was nice, but doctors just kept coming in. We're working on her. And I was just like, yeah, this is it. And my sister and mom were just falling apart. My dad and I were just staring, stunned, and then it was done, and we went in to see her, and she was gone, and held my sister after she had passed away, and it was just surreal. And driving home, it was the strangest thing. We're driving home, Twin Falls. I've driven down this road many, many times. And it just struck me how the whole world was still going on. It was just another day. Mm-hmm. And they're going about their business, doing their thing. And it was just like I wanted to scream to the world just to stop and to recognize what had just happened. And I mean, I'm 15, but I know, of course, that they don't know. And, yeah. and that, but it's what I felt. It was like, man, I just wish people would know what we're going through. And then we went home, and honestly, we sat on the couch the rest of the day, because that was in the morning. And my pastor was there, and we just basically watched old classic movies. It was just like, we just couldn't do much of anything. It's like, we just need to sit. And my pastor just sat with us, and we eventually told some stories, you know, about Katie. And my grandparents were in California. They immediately booked a plane and flew up. They were there that night, which really meant a lot. And you know, then it was just that weird thing you go through. You got to plan a service, and so then it was. Then I had time to really wrestle with what in the world do I think about this with my faith.
What, before you go there, what was your relationship with Katie like, would you say?
Yeah, really good. I mean, she was 7.5 years younger, but man, we had a great time. And she, because of her epilepsy, she was, you know, probably mentally the age of a 2-year-old, so pretty limited, but man, she's just a fun kid, just a very happy kid. We would play together all the time. And my sister and I took care of her a lot, as we were getting older. And the night before, actually, never forget, it was just I feel like a gift from God. She had been in bed. And I was still up with my parents sitting on the couch watching TV or something. And then Katie came down, had gotten out of bed, and she just ran over to me and jumped up on my lap just to sit with me. And so, of course, she's not getting in trouble for that, but it was just a precious moment. I mean, that was really my last moment with her. And even that week afterwards, it was just flashbacks to the stuff I had done with her the week before, just playing with her, you know? I mean, downstairs in the playroom, bouncing a ball over her head and just running around, laughing and playing and having a great time. And that was, you know, that memory actually is what triggered. It was, our house was full of people maybe the day before her service. And just that happy memory just triggered, I just started bawling. I just lost it. And again, my family just saw it, and we hugged and cried together and mourned. I think that obviously made it hard. Had a great relationship with her.
You talk about wrestling with it.
Yeah.
I know, excuse me, I know that scripturally, when you try to look for any, you know, direct statements about children, it's difficult to draw a theology. Mm. A lot of it's really inferential.
Yeah.
How have you come to terms with that? What do you think about that? What do you think about Katie now?
Yeah, I think, you know, even as I shared my own understanding of Jesus at a young age, she was exposed to a lot of the same things, just mentally not able to understand it to that degree. But, I mean, definitely, and my parents could testify better to this, but, you know, she responded positively as much as a little kid can in her position. And so I think it was one of those where I probably didn't wrestle too much with the idea that God would you know, receive her into heaven. What I was wrestling with was, okay, so we prayed for, you know, 6 years or more, seven, you know, of her having this epilepsy, believing God could heal her. We had hundreds of people, our whole church, hundreds and hundreds of people praying for years that God would heal her. Hmm. And I believed he could. And then this is how it ended. And so that's what I was wrestling with is, what in the world, God?
Yeah.
But I remember journaling about it that week and wrestling with that question. And I really just feel like God was gracious to me to help me see it from a different angle, which was, okay, you prayed for me to heal her, to take away the pain, so she wouldn't have to wear a helmet anymore because she would smack her head or bite through her lip or whatever with all these seizures, be on medication. She had brain surgery, all this stuff. And it hit me like, man, she is completely whole now. Mm. Completely. Like, talk about an answer to prayer. Like, she is completely restored. And I thought, man, right now, I really believe she's with God. And so would I want to take her back here now? I was like, no, for her sake, no. Yeah. For her sake, like, oh, my goodness, what a blessing. She's done with all of that. For us, oh, man, it's so hard. It's really hard. But I thought, what a gift to me to have that perspective, because it just gave me peace. And because I knew when I was like, man, I'm at one of those points that I've heard other people, you know, be in this point where I can either say, you know what, God, if that's what you're going to do, if that's what you're like and you're not going to answer prayers how we want or whatever, this is what you're going to let happen to a great family that loves you, then you know what, forget it. I'm done. Like, I don't believe the kind of God that I've been told about. Or I can go, you know what, I have no idea what all is behind this, but I know God is good, and this does not change that. And God, help me to follow you. Help me to trust you through this time. Help my family to walk through this together. And thankfully, that's the route I went. And I don't take credit for it. I really think God just helped me to see that as a teenager.
Not normally you're, I mean, a 15-year-old, it's very easy to be what's in it for me. Yep. And I think, let me ask this, what did you observe in your parents? Because I imagine your antenna were up, going through a new experience, and how are they responding?
Like, well, my mom really, really struggled, definitely dealt with depression over it. You know, she'd be in a room, the door shut, and I knew my dad was trying to help her and manage, you know, my sister and I and everything else going on. So I could just tell, like, man, something's not going well with mom. But again, because I'd had such a healthy upbringing, I had not been around that before. And so it seemed odd. Now I would know, oh, man, yeah, I know exactly the type of thing she was going through. I was pretty naive to that as a 15-year-old, which in some ways helped me to get through it pretty well.
Sometimes ignorance is a little more blissful.
Yeah, absolutely. So there was one time when I was in the kitchen in the morning. This was maybe a few weeks later, and my dad was making his coffee or something, and he just broke down crying. And it was just me and him, and so it was actually a cool moment because he just told me what the trigger was, and it was he saw this little pill crusher that he used to every morning just grind up her medication, and he just saw that, and it was just it just triggered him. And so obviously he wrestled as a dad who lost his daughter. That was, I mean, it's weird to say it, but really good to see, you know, it's like, yeah, it makes total sense to mourn that. But I would say my dad and I probably mourned and moved through it the quickest. I would say within a couple weeks. I mean, I mourned pretty hard. I journaled, I processed, I went through all that, and then went from that week. I was saying, like, I'm not playing football. Like, I don't care. I don't give a rip about football, which was, I knew was weird because I love football. Yeah. Thankfully, my parents said, no, you need to do it. Just, I missed the first 2 days of practice or whatever. They said, we'll take you down, we'll get your gear, we'll just explain it to the coaches. Yeah. And, you know, within a week, I felt like I was doing pretty well.
You were actually functioning, you're doing your life.
I was fine. And yeah, so much so that I was like, uh-oh, I think something might be wrong with me.
Like, you feel guilty, weird.
Yeah, because I was like, I feel like everyone else is, my mom is not okay. My sister is not okay. Even though she's kind of pretending she's okay. And I was like, am I not dealing with this? Am I not? But even the fact that I was thinking that, I was like, no, I'm pretty sure. Like, I've gone through the stages, and like, I'm doing okay. Like, and looking back, I'm like, yeah, I think I actually just mourned well, and God was gracious to me, and I was able to process it in a pretty healthy way.
There was no, later on, there wasn't some big brick wall you ran into emotionally that said, yeah, I never really did this.
Nope. And there was for my sister, my other sister. She definitely had a very different experience. And she was 13 at the time. Mm-hmm. And I just don't think she had the, I don't know. It's hard for me to go back and analyze. She just didn't process it in as healthy of a way, and some of that she didn't even realize until even a few years ago, as stuff bubbled to the surface even more recently, where she realizes she just basically in her mind, in her 13-year-old mind, pretended like Katie never actually died, almost like she just went away on a long trip somewhere. And it just does a number on you psychologically.
Yeah.
So she never actually fully mourned or grieved or processed that. And then life goes on and you kind of, things get better, but she never actually dealt with it.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. Yeah. Well, I know every grief journey is its own journey.
Yeah.
And sometimes you go with others, but there's, it's almost like you're on the trail together and there's offshoots. This is just me. I got to go on this trail. Yeah. And I think in ministry, one of the things I've learned is that I call it sort of the thumbprint of everyone's unique place in life, personality, circumstances, relationship with God, whatever it is. And being able to take someone at their word and at the same time be attentive enough to be able to speak into their life as needed. But there's a lot of things I think that can be, well, people can try to force on other people, and that's can be damaging and awkward. So the hard thing I would say with your sister, maybe she could have had some counseling earlier on or something, but it's like, that's almost, how do you change that journey that she needs to go on for her? Do you have thoughts on, you know, could we have brought in a better counselor, or what would you have done now?
Yeah, you know, I would love to ask even her and my parents, what was that process like? Because as a 15-year-old boy, I was kind of like, oh, I'm kind of moving on. And Carrie, by nature, is such a happy person that that's the face she put on for other mm-hmm. people. And I just believed it. I was yeah. just this naive teenager still, and I thought she was fine until mm-hmm. a couple years later, it's like, oh, she's apparently not doing great. Seems like there's some tension there. Parents are trying to deal with it, but I'm sure they've got it. And I think she'll be fine. Yeah. And she and I had a great relationship. Uh-huh. And so I just, I would love to ask what kind of attention she did get. I don't know that she got any sort of counseling. But looking back, yeah, I think that absolutely would have been a helpful thing. I'm not sure. So... It is interesting. I think now, being 40, looking back, just totally you're, different insights. Yeah,
you're not 40.
I am actually. Oh, man. I am. Yep. So yeah. It is really interesting looking back. I would love to ask what that was like.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I know those things. So you started out talking about this idyllic family.
Yeah.
And then you share one of the most horrifying events that anyone can experience. Mm. And I think that, well, I know you, and I'm, from what I know of you, Billy, you are, you're a joyful, I see you as a joyful optimist.
Mm. Yeah.
I mean, I just, is that hardwired? Is that your nature, your personality?
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. Growing up, that is how I definitely would have described myself, into marriage even. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I remember sitting in staff meetings.
Angie's also a joyful optimist, isn't she?
Oh, well, maybe not the same exact bent. She's very joyful. Maybe not bent toward optimism as strongly as me. We'll say that. But we, you know, we'd sit in a staff meeting and you'd be there and Tim would ask, you know, on a scale of 1 to 8, how you doing? And the joke was always, Billy's always an 8.
One to 10. Yeah.
1 to 10. I'm an 8.
You're like, I'm an 8.
And then I still remember Angie being like a 3 or a 4 and you were like, man, I just, if Lori's not doing well, I'm not doing well. And it really It impacted me. I was like, you know what? There's something right about that. And I feel like I'm still, at that point of my life, I was still just on this journey to be able to empathize at a deeper level.
Wow.
Even with what Angie was going through, I was more like, I can be fine when she's not.
Yeah.
And I saw that as a good thing. And part of that is good, but there's another part that's like, man.
Well, what's so funny, Billy, is my journey's been the other way. It was, I think, a healthy, unhealthy attachment for me in that way. It's kind of ended up being all about me in a roundabout way, because if she's not doing well, then it's, somehow it's my fault, and I have to scramble and figure out how to fix things or whatever. Yeah. It's actually, I've moved more toward, well, you know, she's going to have to work that out, but I have responsibilities I got to do, and I've been, but it just feels like it's this this sound of Velcro tearing apart, just this long process. Yeah. I don't just make the decision and go there. It's been a growth process, but it's ironic that you're there. Well, I'm glad that God, I hope, I'm inferring here that God used that in a positive way in your life, not just
absolutely.
Like, Bill's a weirdo.
No, that's why I still remember it. But I would say I'm still an optimist naturally, but, you know, the older you get, the more you see of the world and people and evil, and it's like, I'm also more realistic, and so...
I think your ability to recognize how great your family was growing up, your family of origin, comes from all the things you've seen. I mean, you've talked to hundreds, if not thousands, of students over the years. You've been on summer projects. You've heard what people have come from. And I think that's made you more deeply, well, aware and grateful as well.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. I just had no idea how hard, you know, life is for most people. Just how many hard things people go through. I was so naive to that. And I still remember Crew Summer Mission, and Dr. David Ekman came in and had us do this survey and kind of how to see how healthy your family background was. And I was so skeptical. I was like, what can you tell me from a 14-question survey? But we did it, and then he divided us up into these three groups, and I was in the healthy group and kind of the extreme end of the healthy group. And we went through this whole process, and my eyes just came open to things. I was like, what in the world? Like, this is amazing. And a lot of it centered around ability to trust people. Mm-hmm. It's like when your trust has been broken over and over and over, yeah, you don't naturally trust people. They have to earn it. And I was the opposite. I was like, well, no, people have been good. Yeah. And so I naturally just trust them until
innocent
they break
until
it.
Innocent until proven guilty.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So there was this interesting thing in the room when students are seeing each other answer in different ways, and some even being upset over it. Like, people who came from a more, the way he phrased it was dysfunctional family background, mm-hmm. unhealthy background, when they heard some of us from a healthier family background say, yeah, we just trust people, trust God, because he was asking, like, how easy is it for you to trust God or trust other people? Oh, yeah, easy. And they literally were like, they looked angry at us, and we're right. like, what in the world? And so he then asked them, what do you guys think about their answers? Like, why don't you guys just tell the truth? We're like, what do you mean? We are telling the truth.
Yeah.
And then it just started hitting me, like, oh, man, that I had no idea how my background affected me. And I honestly, Angie and I had just started dating, and she was not at this Crew Summer Mission. So I called her. I was like, hey, I'm going to send you this thing. I need you to take this survey because I have a feeling that we are on opposite ends of the spectrum. And she took it, and we were polar opposites.
Really?
And it was so helpful, because even some things that Dr. Ekman said was like, okay, you guys in the healthy family group, here are a few things you should, like, never say to other people that come from harder backgrounds. Don't throw out these Christian platitudes like, well, just trust God. I was like, oh, shoot. what do you mean?
Like, that was my go-to.
That's my go-to thing. Like, right. If Angie's struggling with something, I'm like, well, you just need to trust God. And then I was always amazed that she didn't find that very helpful. And so then I was like, oh, wow, man, I have a lot to learn here.
Yeah.
And so thankfully that, yeah, I think I've grown a little bit in that. That's not my go-to phrase anymore, even though, honestly, at the very root of things, way deep down, I think that still is it.
Right.
It's like, no, you need to get to a place where you actually can truly trust God, because right. that changes everything, everything. But that's not my first step in a conversation.
You know, I remember hearing that if something is natural to you or comes easily, and you think, say, like throwing a ball or hitting a golf ball is always and you just say, it's point A to point B. It's like, here, throw this ball right into that catcher's glove where he's holding it. And somebody can do that. Yeah. There's people that can just do that and, throw it. Oh, good. Okay. Mm. Well, let's call that step one. Okay. Yeah. Well, other people, they can't. That goes over the backstop or goes way in the dirt or whatever. And you have to break it down then.
Yep.
And I think for someone that has the healthy background, it's trust. Mm. It's not something you have to break down. Right. It's natural. Yep. But then with someone else, and I know he's got there's the confused, the religiously confused family in there between the healthy and the dysfunctional. Mm-hmm. And one of the things I remember Dr. Ekman saying was that the dysfunctional people know that they're dysfunctional. Their eyes are pretty much fully opened to it.
Yeah.
And the religiously confused is this gray scale, and they think they're okay, but they've got wrong definitions. So yeah. You think you experience unconditional love.
Yeah.
And then he starts asking some follow-up questions. You know, would they have loved you more if this? Oh, yeah. Mm. Would they have loved you more if you got better grades? Well, yeah. What if you'd been a better athlete?
Mm.
Yeah. It's like, okay, you see what you're saying?
Yeah.
You're using the term unconditional love, and you're describing conditional love.
Right. Yeah.
And so that's one of those aha wake up moments that you have to go through. That's pretty interesting. Well,
yep.
My point being that I think for someone like the rest of us or Angie, that there's, you know, just using the word trust has to be broken down.
Yep.
And that's where I think it's helpful to some of those other terms. Could you lean in to God a little bit here, or you know, whatever it is that helps. I don't know. Yeah. And probably what helps is you just not saying that, right?
Yes. It's kind of a joke now.
What about just pray? That's another one.
just pray and read your Bible.
Right.
Everything will be better.
It's right.
Like, well, those are good things, actually. But
this is a little bit of a different direction, but you had mentioned playing football.
Yeah.
And you went in, you played high school football. You told me a story once about coming up against the guy that ended up playing at Boise State.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Tell me that story, because because you're a good athlete, but you're not a huge guy.
I'm not a huge guy. No.
What was your plan weight in high school?
140.
Yeah.
140.
I don't think that qualifies as huge.
No, not at all. And so I was a defensive back, and I wish I had known he'd go on to be a starter fullback for Boise State. I would have felt better about it probably, and I might not have hit him the same way. I don't know, but no, we were playing Capital. I was playing for Twin Falls, and Brad Lau was their fullback. And
was he more than 140?
Oh my God, he was at least 240. I mean, he had me by 100 pounds at least. That's not an exaggeration. And I think he was heavier at Boise State even than that. But he was just flying up the middle, untouched, and I came flying up the middle the other way. So it was a full-on, you know, head-on collision. And I was smart enough to go down low. It's like, I'm not taking this guy down. So I went down low. Well, he kind of juked into me, and I just planted my helmet right on his knee or his quad. And I watched the game film. He did a complete flip off of my head.
Yeah.
Well, you know, and it just knocked me out cold.
Oh,
I just not because, and I don't remember that part. I just remember opening my eyes, and I'm in the huddle, and they're picking me off the ground for the next play. And I ready break. I was like, what? And I went out to cover my receiver, and I just remember squinting because all I had was like peripheral vision.
Oh yeah.
I couldn't see.
Yeah.
But I was like, the play is starting. I can't call a timeout. I was like, I was just hoping they wouldn't throw it to my guy. And so I went out, paramedics looked at me like, man, you got your bell rung bad. If you puke, you're gonna have to go to the hospital. And sure enough, I got out of there, out of the game. I got home and puked and had to go to the hospital.
You had a concussion,
bad concussion. Yeah. Oh. I sat in the emergency room with my dad, the waiting room. Mm-hmm. And there was a guy across from me still in his football pads with a broken arm.
Mm-hmm.
And I was so nauseous. And they tell you, you can't sleep. And by now it's like 11 at night, 11:30. So tired. And I remember just kind of glaring at this guy with a broken arm thinking, you lucky dog. You are so lucky. All you have is a busted arm. Like, this is way worse. So concussions are bad news.
Oh yeah,
it's not good.
Well, they know more about the protocols and all that now than they did back then.
But
back then it's like snap to it. We got another play.
Yep.
I hear that now and I just wince with all the stuff that we've learned. Yeah. So
Brad Lau, though, he went. Yeah. He played for Boise State.
Was that nice? When did Brad ever send you any kind of?
He didn't.
Nothing.
It's almost like he didn't care. Yeah, amazing. No good hit or anything.
It's almost like he just ran over you like 140-pound defensive back.
He was probably embarrassed. A little guy made him do a complete flip.
That's true. You did that.
Yeah.
Yeah, you've always been good with your head.
Well, yeah, they teach you not to tackle like that.
Right.
I just claim he juked into me. It wasn't my fault.
Well, Anyway, that's one of those. You talk about playing football. Yeah. And I know you've been an athlete all those years. Since you married that you started in doing triathlons?
Yeah. I think I was like 26. So married a couple years. This is an Olympics year. That was an Olympics year. And it was a box of Wheaties that had a triathlete on it. And I was just sitting there eating breakfast, reading about it. I was like, that's awesome. I think I might want to try that. So
had you done all three activities before, swimming, biking, and running?
No, I mean, I just played team sports.
Okay.
And did not find pleasure in just pure running.
Right.
I made fun of my cross country friends who didn't play football. Now I know better. I'm like, those guys are amazing.
Yeah.
I swam like in lakes and rivers, but I had never swam a lap in my life.
Right.
And the bike, I loved riding my bike around, but I'd never been on a road bike.
Right.
And never raced a bike at all. So
you just said, I'm going to do this, or I'm going to try it?
I'm going to try it, yeah. And so in Nampa, they had an indoor triathlon in the winter. And I thought, perfect, because I don't have to buy the bike.
Stationary bike.
You swim in the pool, so I don't have to buy a wetsuit or any of that. And I'll
jog
just
around
see if
the
I like
track.
It.
Yeah, they had
actually a large indoor track. And I was like, that's cool. It was cheap, so... But I did it, and, man, I was hooked. I was like, I got to do this again. So I got into it. Yeah.
You've got a competitive fire in you.
Yeah.
Are you the kind that can I'm a team sport guy.
Yeah.
I love – it's almost the more the dynamics of the team that get me motivated. And so my competitiveness, I feel like, is fueled from being with the team.
Yep.
And I can see you. It's almost like I can see your vision lock in to this number. Yeah. So I'm going to beat that number. I'm going to better myself. I mean, is that true?
100%. Yeah. And I love the team sports too. I mean, that fires me up as well. But it's so true, Bill. Even this week, we went bowling with our kids. And thankfully, as I've matured, I can play a game or whatever, and no one will know what's going on inside my head.
Yeah.
But it's very hard to shut off completely the competitive side.
Yeah.
Even if it's 100% internal. And so, even if it's bowling and I'm having a bad game, I'm still thinking, but it's not over yet.
Yeah.
I could still bowl three strikes in the 10th frame and still get this score with my kids.
Yeah, right.
Who are playing monster bowling with bumpers next to me,
That's funny.
Or golfing with Angie this past week, same thing. And she just laughs at me because she knows it's just how I am. She'll just laugh like, I have never had that thought cross my mind ever. Like,
you know, this is a side note. I would love for you to come out to the Ultimate Training Camp with AIA because you would fit right in with that crowd. It is such an interesting thing to get 150 college athletes out there, and they're so much on that same wavelength.
Yeah.
And it's like you throw a ball out in the middle of the field, and it's just they're just transformed, you know. And so it's such an incredible opportunity. And then through my involvement with that and studying theology of sport and that, there's a lot of things that go into it. Now, it's interesting because I lived with a pastor who said, he just views sports as, quote, a colossal waste of time. Hmm. And I remember watching it. So we'll just sit down and watch it. He watched the last inning of a baseball game. We were living over in Tacoma at the time, and it was Mariners, and they tied. And he goes, well, that was neat.
Oh.
And I go, no, it's going into extra innings. He goes, what, there's more?
Well,
it was nine innings. So I think, and I'm somewhere, I can recognize that side of things.
Yeah.
But I also understand just what athletics is all about and what it can be, the best the best aspects of it.
Yep.
And especially the notion of, you know, what are we as human beings in the image of God? That has something to do with we're an embodied soul. Yeah. So our bodies matter.
Yeah.
And that physical fitness, that discipline seems to carry over into other areas of our lives. And I think it affects us spiritually. So
totally.
Talk about how what you think that interplay for you has been as you, and you're not just doing it in a slouch. You've been competitive in your sport, in the triathlon. You've done it for how many do you think you've done by now? How many triathlons? Yeah.
Maybe 30 some.
What's the biggest one you've done?
A half Ironman.
Okay.
Yeah.
Wow.
So. That's a bit.
That's amazing.
Then I started having kids. So I was like, I don't have time for the long stuff, even though I'd love to. It's a time commitment.
It is, but, isn't it?
I see why Paul used sports metaphors, you know, and even in training or in races, especially many times what's going through my mind, because you know, a race like that with endurance, it's just how much pain can you endure?
Right. Like,
because no one's got a gun to your head. Like, you don't have to push it that hard, but I want to. And it's like, what is the maximum I can push my body, you know, without collapsing before the finish line? And so
right now, whoever's listening to this, I guarantee you, there are people that they stop whatever else they're doing and they're leaning forward. They're like, yes, here's a guy that's got to figure it. And there are people that are reaching for the knob going, this guy is nuts.
Totally. They're
like, it's not about that, you know, but I know, I totally get that. Yep. I understand that.
And you did a mini sprint triathlon just to see what I do.
Mm-hmm.
And she's like, yep, it's confirmed. You're crazy. Like, why do you do this to yourself? That was terrible. But I just think it is an incredible metaphor for life. Like, there are so many times I'll be just pushing it, and I'll think, man, this is what life is either like or going to be like.
Mm.
And it really many times turns into prayer. I'm just like, God, help me in life to persevere and to push to the finish and to not just back off and coast.
Mm.
Because I just know, man, no one's out here. No one even knows what I'm doing right now.
Yeah.
Other than if I upload it to Strava, which I like, and anyone who's into running or biking.
Strava is
it's an app. Yeah.
But I mean,
it tracks every segment of, you know, your run or your bike, and it has your times, all of your times, your personal records, and compares you to other people who have done it. It's for someone like me, it's a dream. Yeah. It's just amazing.
And you described a nightmare.
Exactly.
For others.
Yeah,
that is so funny.
Yeah. Do you pay for that? It's like, I would sacrifice a lot of things to be able to analyze my workouts like that. Anyway, it's like no one else is pushing me. But in many ways, I think that'll be life too. Like, life will get hard and I could just coast. Like, I could take an easier route, but I don't want to do that. Like, I've got this life to live, and I want to do it to the max of the potential that God's created me with and the opportunities he's giving me. What a bummer if I just coasted, you know? So, man, it motivates me not just to exercise, but in life very much.
So the crossover, sometimes you might... I mean, anybody that's ever run anything, I did one 10K in my life. It's just kind of say I did it. But there's that moment where you're running and everything in your body's telling you to stop.
Yeah.
Like, you know, wisdom suggests you should be laying down in that grass over there now, right. You know, 10 minutes ago, but you're running and you don't stop. But I think it's grueling because it's like a note that just increases in intensity and volume and it's stop.
Yep.
And you overcome that. And I know there's little games within that. How does that translate to other than Other than a cross-country road trip with your kids that all want to go to the bathroom.
Yeah.
So other than that, you know, in life, yeah. what are things that you might even sense that same little, instinct to overcome? Yeah. What's a circumstance in life that would apply to?
Yeah. I mean, sheesh, I don't even have to go beyond this morning. I feel like, you know, I'm a team leader with crew, which I love. People ask, are you going to keep doing that or go to engineering or do something? I'm like, man, I love what I do.
Yeah. Which there's a new development there too. We can chat about in a minute.
Yeah. But part of it is because of the challenge. So there are definitely challenges there. Also an elder at my church. And that is a great honor, but also, man, it's hard. There are just challenges as a part of that, and relationships that I have with people in the church or family where they're just going through hard things, and I feel compelled to enter into that with them. But with all of those, it's like, man, I could just back off here. Like someone else can do that. And my life would be a lot easier if I could just remove some of those things. I could chart a much easier path in life, and just coast and still have a good life and still live for God and still, you know, serve people and live for the kingdom and all of that. But I lean the other direction. Yeah. I say, no, I need to have wisdom to not overcommit. And not burn out and all of those things. But
does the physical competition, the triathlons and training, does that help with that wisdom? In other words, we all know what an alcoholic, a workaholic is that says, just, I can't not, I always say yes, I always work harder, there's nothing.
Yeah. I think it does because, especially, I mean, triathlon is so unique because it's three totally different sports, but they're back to back, and you really are trying to maximize your speed, obviously. Mm-hmm. But you have to learn your body and each sport and efficiency, and you have to just be totally dialed into listening to your body and knowing where's that line, where's, you know, where you're not redlining it, you're going to flame out. Even nutrition, like how does my body react to nutrition and stuff? Like you want to optimize it. And you just know then when you're going too hard. It's like, I cannot sustain that. And so I have to back off, even if I don't want to. I have to. And so like on the bike, bike's my favorite. And on the bike, I want to just blast it the whole way. But I know if I go into the run and do that, I'm just hosed on the run. Mm. I'm just going to flame out.
Yeah.
And so
that's a really good analogy because you're holding back in one discipline.
Yep.
Not for just the end of that race, but or that section. You're holding off so that you can perform in another area.
Exactly. And even my favorite one. I mean, I have to hold back in my favorite one where I could do even better, but it's like, no, that's not the whole race.
Right.
So I want to do well over too.
That's a great analogy.
Yeah.
Well, and I think about that where, you know, people talk about the work, you know, home life balance or whatever, and you've got an elders meeting and then you've got something else and maybe you have you're delivering a talk at crew and you got all these things. You can sense that red line and you go, you know what, I need to pull back. How does that affect just life in general, home life and that? I mean, I would imagine Angie's voice weighs in there.
Yeah.
And
if I ever hear her saying, you know, all you do is work or you don't have enough time for your family, it's like, oh, I my goal is to never hear that.
Yeah.
Like that, I want to cut that off before it ever gets to that point.
Sure.
Some of it is even my own health, and I've just learned the hard way. I would say similar in, you know, you learn your limits the hard way in sports. I've had to learn that similarly with just life and how much I take on. And it is similar kind of warning signs, paying mm-hmm. attention. And sometimes it is even physical.
Right. It's like, yeah, you've fought through some injuries. You had to take some time off, didn't you?
Yep.
Yeah, I can't remember what it was.
Yeah.
Knee, was it?
Well, this past year was knee. Yeah. I had torn meniscus and also had, I thought it was COVID, but it was a mono relapse. Mm. 7 months of fatigue and just couldn't go exercise really, which is that's a bummer for me. I love to be doing something every day, but
this is what's funny to me. I was talking to the joyful optimist because you don't expect.
Yeah.
These, whoa, you know, that would be the first thing out of some people's mouth. It's 7 months of this. Yeah. And that. Yeah, I don't even know about it until I probe about three questions deep. Yeah. It's like, oh, yeah, by the way, I had 7 months of mono. That's, that's another, I need to wear my What Would Billy Do bracelet. That's awesome.
Well, I when we had younger kids, wasn't sleeping, you know, I was getting woke up in the night a lot. One thing I learned the hard way was to listen to my body and know my limits because I just kept pushing. It was like, there's the strength of maybe the attitude of you just push through it, just keep grinding, push through. But you go too far and you pay the price for it. And mm-hmm. I did. I still remember one day driving home from campus, long day on campus, hadn't slept great. I was like fighting, nodding off, driving down Chinden, but instead of, the thought went through my mind, dude, just go home, like you're shot. Well, I was like, nope, got to get my swim in because mm-hmm. I'm training mm-hmm. for a triathlon. I got to just, and so I did. I went and swam, and then it was not much longer that I started having seizures.
Seizures?
Yeah, it was simple partial seizures. And basically the verdict after I went and got all checked out was just extreme exhaustion.
Wow.
I was just pushing my body too hard.
What's the seat? Would you actually black out or
nope,
would you?
Nope. It was just, the short way of describing it, be totally conscious and you probably wouldn't even know anything's happening if you were observing me. Mm-hmm. But in my mind, it was like this extreme sense of deja vu and like rapid fire memories almost.
Interesting.
Almost like a dream while you're awake, but really rapid and deja vu. And then it would be over and I could not, it's like when you have a dream and you wake up and you can't remember the dream. Okay. You know, I was just dreaming and it was so vivid, but I don't have a clue what it was. It was seconds ago.
Uh-huh.
And then just left completely drained.
Okay.
So not good. And that took months to recover from. And I just had to basically stop exercising. Like I'd eventually go on walks and stuff, but I just knew I needed more sleep, more rest. And I don't like that. Yeah. I want to push it all the time.
It,
I was like, no, I can't. And so a phrase I used to use with Angie was like, I'm not Superman. I can't do all of this stuff. Mm-hmm. And she's very ambitious too. And so where there's always a house project going on.
You guys are the DIY king and queen.
Yeah, there's a lot happening.
It's like, who'd you hire to do this? Oh, I did it myself. YouTube.
Yeah. So I some of the ways I've had to put in things I put in practice knowing myself now is like, I take naps. Mm-hmm. I just take 20 or 30 minute naps. And I used to feel guilty, even mm-hmm. to the point I'd almost try to hide it from Angie, that I was taking a nap, like do it when she's not home or something.
Yeah.
And it's like, man, that's not healthy. If I need a nap, I need a nap. Like, especially when we had little kids and we're not sleeping through the night.
Right.
But even now we'll do with crew, for our staff, like once a month, take a half day with the Lord, just go do whatever, mm-hmm. you know? And so for me, I'll usually go to the river or something, just take my chair, my lounge camping chair, mm-hmm. and find a spot by the river where there's no people and bring a good drink or something and a book. And what I started doing is I'd usually by that time, I'm so tired, but I used to think, man, but I've got to maximize this time. I've got a few hours here. I got to, I want to read all this stuff and whatever. And I finally one day was like, okay, time with the Lord. So imagine Jesus is standing right here with me or sitting in his chair. Like, what would Jesus say to me? Like, how would he want to spend this time with me? And it was almost instant. I was like, I know exactly what he'd say. He'd say, Billy, take a nap, man. Like, just take a nap. And then wake up and have your coffee and be refreshed. And then let's hang out. Like, let's talk. Let's whatever.
Yeah.
And I started doing that, and it was awesome. I was like, oh, I just feel...
Best day with the Lord ever.
Yes, I just love it. I'm like, I am so relaxed and refreshed. And then I'm like, actually alert to read or think or pray or journal or whatever. And I do think some of that even has come from learning my limits in sports and stuff. It's like just paying attention to my body, my spirit, my mental state, all of it.
Yeah, man, that's so powerful. Mm-hmm. And I think about that again, that mind body connection. Mm-hmm. You know, we're immaterial and we're material. And as human beings, we have a unique presence in that, in this universe. Mm. And in some ways, the flesh is not all bad. You know, Paul talks about, oh, that wicked flesh. And definitely there are habits that are formed in the flesh that are inherent in that flesh that we have to fight against. Mm. But then there's the other side that, you know, you've heard stories about the ascetic monks who would sit on top of a pole, you know, put little, you know, worm would fall off of their rotting flesh and they'd put the worm back and say, eat well, my little friend, or whatever. And it's like such a, that's the opposite end and sort of a bizarre Gnostic belief that would creep in. And I think that Gnosticism is something that naturally creeps into the church in any setting. It's this split between the spiritual and the physical. And I, you know, even as I'm saying it, I'm, my coach used to say, you know, point a finger at someone else and you got three fingers pointing right back at you, because I see it in my own, in my own consciousness sometimes. And, but that to me is one of the best things that I draw from you. Like you're a real inspiration to me. Now you may say, well, it doesn't look like it. In my defense, I had reconstructive ankle surgery, and he said I should not be running long distances.
Well.
And that was going to be my big thing.
But you're poised to become a distance runner.
When I started swimming years ago, a friend of mine said, "Yeah, I use swimming. Just a lot of times, I'll just pray." And you know, when I started out, it's like, pray.
Try not to die.
Yeah, the only pray is like, you know, oxygen, breathe. And it's like, Lord, don't let me die.
Right.
But when you get into the rhythm, it's amazing how you can get into kind of that rhythm with it and in the right pace and everything. And my mind just kind of gets released to think about other things that I'm either thinking about. Sometimes I'm, you know, kind of regurgitating stuff a little bit and bouncing it off the Lord. It's like, what do I do about this? What do I do? What are some plans of, you know, even just practical stuff, or maybe going through, I know I'll be teaching Romans this fall on Tuesday nights, and I'm thinking about some of that and what, you know, the implications or of the definition of how we define the righteousness of God and how does that. So it's funny, because all that goes on in your head when someone looks, oh, he's just swimming.
Right.
It's like, no, there's a lot more going on there.
Absolutely.
And
absolutely.
And the breathing for me, the exertion, it's all really good. My thing is, when do you work out?
Typically, like during the school year, it's typically right before dinner.
Okay, actually. So you, that to me is, I know these people, they, and I'm still open to the possibility, but they talk about working out in the morning and they get up earlier. And I've got good friends, they do the cycle class at like 5 a.m.
Oh man,
at the Y. Yeah. And I've done that before, I've tried multiple times.
Yeah.
And I'm dead the rest of the day. Like, I just, I'm not, I'm not functioning. I mean, I'm there in body, but it's like all I want to do is slump over.
Yeah.
And it's like all that energy and mental acuity, that wasn't delivered for me. So, the afternoon for me was, in fact, when I did run, it was in seminary. I'd come back from class, usually 3:30.
Yeah.
And I started taking a nap right then.
Mm.
And after a couple times where I took an actual 3-hour nap and then staggered over to the cafeteria, I thought, okay, this is not, you know, because then you eat, you know. And so I said, I'm going to start doing some exercise. So I started running.
Yeah.
And then that helped get things into a better rhythm. It's like, well, I'm maybe not, you know, have enough mental acuity now to think through Hebrew, but I can go run.
Right.
And I'd do that. And then I'd go eat. And then I was sleeping better at night, too. So,
yep. Yeah.
That's amazing. Well, you've learned a lot in your years, and sometimes it's hard to know what you've learned. One of the things I wanted to ask you today, Billy, is when you meet, I mean, we have the same lingo, having been trained with crew and, you know, building a movement. And we were laughing earlier before we started recording just about, well, they've changed the lingo right. on some things, right. but it's really this, you know, it's like, what is it? Azure is the new sky blue or right. something like that.
Right.
But what is, what is it you're trying to accomplish in the life of a student? A student comes here as a freshman.
Yeah.
And they're looking around, and they've got a background that you probably know the spectrum within which they're probably likely falling in terms of their health of their family, and here they come and what they're dealing with.
Yeah.
Everyone's unique, but you've seen a lot.
Yeah.
What's your hope for that freshman who arrives at Boise State?
Yeah. I mean, ultimate hope is that they would become a lifelong follower of Jesus, wherever they're at their starting point. So step one is where you're at, and let's go from there, which is what I love about what we get to do with crew is it's really is focused on the entire campus. So any student, whether they're completely far from God and hostile, I actually love engaging with them and just hearing their story. Mm-hmm. And that used to intimidate me, but now I just know there is some probably really good reason that they are that way. Mm-hmm. And so I just love being surprising to them, to actually care about them, to not be thrown off when they, you know, probably try to scare me off. And to see their shocked look when I just ask them genuine questions and care about them. Mm-hmm. I love that. Then there's the students who are right on the edge, you know, it's like, man, they're actually looking for God, for answers. They're seeking, and it's what a fun thing to introduce them. Here's what you're looking for. It's Jesus. And then for those who were like me, who grew up in the church and maybe know quite a bit of stuff, but they still need to learn. They still need to grow, you know, just what does this look like to be a light in the classroom around your friends, to be intentional, to, have deeper conversations with them about life, to actually care about them instead of just yourself in college. And then up to the more mature students who just want to actually study the Bible in a deeper way and see it translate to their daily life and go on mission and reach the world, you know, make disciples. It's like, man, all of those things are super enjoyable to me. But the ultimate, is just to fulfill what Jesus said, to go make disciples of all nations. Mm-hmm. That's what crew is about. That's what I want my life to be about. And it begins with learning yourself, just to be a disciple of Jesus yourself, to walk with him, to become more like him day by day, but then to go help others do the same, to disciple them toward the same thing.
We've known for years in the church, there are certain things that seem to just click well with women.
Hmm.
Men can be an interesting challenge.
Mm-hmm.
I remember hearing one friend of mine in seminary speaking to our little group one time, and he said, you know, what we want to be in America is the Marlboro man.
Mm-hmm.
Look at him out there. He's on his horse.
Mm-hmm.
He's cooler than all get out. He doesn't need anyone. he'll use his horse till he dies and then he'll walk or whatever it is. I mean, there's something about that image for a man that's like, I am a standalone loner that can do it. And then, you know, that like at the, my core, my being, I've got that in me. And then you're trying to get guys to show up and talk about things that they're not good. The other thing I know is guys like to do things that guys are good at. And so they might try something once and then they're never doing it again. You know, but if they're good at Frisbee, guess what? They're going out for the ultimate Frisbee and that's what they're going to spend their time doing. Which, you know, so you, I think men talking about spiritual things, it's esoteric. It's, it's abstract. It's a little out there. And putting that into play in your own life and emotions and obedience. And for you, the challenge of reaching a discipling young man, what's the challenge? And then what are some of the steps that you take to overcome that?
Yeah, man, that's a great question. I'll just admit from the outset, we're still trying to figure it out. I feel like it's an ongoing mystery and challenge, because, you know, in a couple weeks we'll go meet incoming freshmen, we'll do all the stuff we do, and it's pretty easy to get ladies to show up to stuff and to agree to meet and talk, and you're right, it is trickier even to get that initial interaction with guys. It's like we can't even talk until we even like meet and and do anything, you know. So some of it is, I mean, you mentioned Frisbee. We're gonna go do disc golf, we're gonna do mountain biking, we're gonna go hike Table Rock, we're gonna hang in the park and do a spike ball tournament, because for some guys, especially just coming in, they're just looking to meet friends and have a good time. So that may draw them.
Some guys, minor percentage.
Well, yeah, I mean, and it, honestly,
I mean, I'm saying that joking because I think most guys, that's kind of where guys are at.
But then also aware of plenty of guys, you know, who aren't into that and maybe feel left out. Maybe they're just not into sports and stuff. And so lots of other activities that, that would be a draw to them. But, you know, one way or another, we try to get in touch with them. But then it is, like you say, it's, for me, it's pretty easy to just sit down, let's grab coffee and talk across the table. Well, it's helpful to know. Yeah, for them, they're squirming in their seats.
Oh, yeah.
I still remember that myself. I remember being in the sub my, the year I transferred here. So I was a junior.
Yeah, student union building.
Yep, student union building. And I was pretty mature in my faith, I guess, relative to my peers. But I still remember sitting with, it was either a student leader or a staff person, and they started talking about Jesus. And I instinctively was like, shh, quiet down.
They're don't gonna, say it out loud.
People are going to hear you. Like, we can talk, but just like quieter. And even that, I was instantly aware of that in myself. I was like, why is that? Why do I care if others hear us talking about Jesus? So interesting, my own growth journey. But I realize, a lot of guys feel that way. But also just to sit face to face and talk in person is such a foreign thing, especially about anything serious.
Right.
For guys, they can text, they can message, they can kind of sit side by side and watch something and maybe talk about something. But so I think there is a sense where we need to adjust some of that. And so sometimes it's, let's go do something together and we'll talk while we're doing it. For a lot of guys, that can just be a lot more comfortable.
Yeah.
And then once there's trust, well, then you can actually sit down and have a deeper conversation.
Right. Yeah. I think that's, I mean, you hit the nail on the head, which is what crew and we've tried to do is, what are the activities? We call it shoulder to shoulder stuff. Well, you just did that with your own son. You just took
Cooper
backpacking out there.
Yeah.
And he had a couple days and went in, and that was a good... Did he seem to enjoy that?
Oh, man. Yeah. It was awesome.
Yeah.
He had a blast. Yeah.
That's great. Those are those memories that you just look back on. And it's chiseled in stone now, and you can't go back and change it.
Yep.
Well, talk about just a little bit as we're getting near the end here. I left full-time staff with Crew and Athletes in Action in 2013 mm-hmm. to take over as director of the Biblical Studies Center. And one of the things that was really important to me right off the bat, in fact, I did a little thought experiment, because I think of this ministry here as this is God's thing. What does God want to use this for? And woe is me if I'm actually holding it back because I'm insistent on I want a certain thing done a certain way and I want it to look like this and be like this. So what if God just had full free reign? And so one of the thoughts, the questions I had, it's like, well, what if we just gave the whole ministry to Crew? And, you know, so that's what I call it a thought experiment because it's just a hypothetical, what would that look like? And the reason I asked is because, I mean, I knew you were on the team and Crew does a lot of things really well. Now, of course, what that did is it bounced back to me and said, there's things that Crew is not about as much and won't do. So it helped me shape a little bit more of our identity here to say, this is how important these partnerships are. And you mentioned it with earlier on, you were talking about how well you work together with Matt O'Brien, the director, or shall I say, former director at Boise State. Yeah. And I'll ask about that in a second. But you get that sort of symbiotic relationship. And to me, that's what is so important about the Biblical Studies Center is I want to be a component that is adding, if you want to call it adding value or adding effectiveness to the advancing kingdom of God here at Boise State. Yeah. And you're just a key part of that. One of the ministries that has really taken advantage of what we're offering here and you have given back, I think, you know, multiple times more than what you've received from us, but you have a little storage room with some of your equipment and things, awesome. which that's great. And but I love seeing Crew in and out of here and other campus ministries as well. I mean, I'm not, but as far as that goes, what are the things that you've seen students maybe plug into here that you say that was good or that was good for them or that came back around and maybe was good for us?
Yep. Well, I am so grateful for the center here. It has been key over the years because I remember years before there was more partnership here and accessibility, and man, it's just made a difference. It's so close, easy for students to get to, that you know we've done just tons of Crew stuff. You know, I could go on about all the meetings we've had here and events and meals and like the amount of life change that's happened in this building is, I mean, it'd take me way too long to even describe it, to even summarize it. It's just so many interactions, conversations that I could say just for myself, let alone all of our students and staff over the years. So that's totally benefiting us. But then, even last night, I was texting with a student that I discipled, and he was asking about a class here. I was like, absolutely, you should do it. And so that is really fun, too, just to be able to point students to what's going on here that Crew isn't doing, but the center is. Even just a place during the week that they can come and study and just know it's going to be a good environment is really nice, especially, man, last year with COVID and all the challenges there. I don't know what we would have done without Biblical Studies Center. I mean, it was like it really was key. I mean, not overstating and totally key to what we did last year. And the cool thing is a lot of students know about it even more now because they were in here so much. And then they can become more aware of the classes that are going on. And I hope that really grows. I hope we can get more and more students taking classes because they're so good. When it's a classic thing where they don't know what they're missing. Like, right. It's so good, but you don't know what you're missing until you've been in it and seen it. So,
Yeah, I agree with that last, especially heading into this semester. We've got just a great lineup, and my challenge is being the ringleader who's trying to juggle while I'm announcing the next act and
right. Yeah.
and raising the big top, yep, while I'm doing it. Yep. And tell you what, having an intern like Ellie who's been doing a little bit more with Instagram, that's been helpful, because awesome. I know,
yep,
all of a sudden someone said, well, my wife said, hey, I got another Instagram about a class. And I said, oh, you did? Good.
There you go.
That reminds me, that should probably be happening,
Yeah. So it's great.
That's great. Well, talk a little bit about your changing role,
yeah,
with crew right now.
Yep. So
Changed.
I've been here, like I said, long time, but started as an intern and then a senior staff, and then I've been one of our team leaders along with Matt O'Brien and Maddie Boserman. Matt and I for 10-11 years together. Matt's been here 12 years. Maddie's been here a while and a team leader for 2. But Matt has taken a new role with crew at more of a national level, which is awesome for crew. It's a bummer for us, but I'm excited for him because of the a great benefit to many more people. But that means I'll be still a team leader, but I had been specifically overseeing operations, and I'll kind of slide over into Matt's role. So Maddie and I will lead our staff team, and we're blessed to have a great staff team.
Yeah,
so,
you do.
Man, it's pretty cool to have that many that we work alongside. I mean, I even got a call while we were sitting here doing this from one of them. I need to call him back. Everyone's gearing up for the school year, getting ready to go. And it's just fun knowing we're doing it together. Matt is a good friend, and we have led together in a way that really complements each other's strengths.
Right.
And so I'm going to miss that a lot. I'm going to miss him. He'll still be here. He still wants to be involved. But obviously, it's a big change.
Yeah, it is.
So
yeah, he'll be helping. It's more of a HR, almost said PR,
yep,
HR, yep, role, right?
Right. Yeah. Yep. So overseeing kind of a big portion of the West for crew.
Yeah.
So yeah, he'll do a great job there.
Well, I know I have total confidence in you that it's going to be another great transition, and you're going to do a great job, Billy. And I hope we get to work again even more closely as we go forward and find ways to partner. And sounds like you've already been talking about, not already, but you're thinking about some of those things. You mentioned disc golf, and you've already got some of those in mind for the fall. Is there anything you're extra excited about for the fall kickoff this year?
Well, yes, actually, mountain biking, because we've never had that in our kickoff.
Yeah.
But last spring during COVID, we couldn't do much group stuff. And I thought, I go mountain biking anyway. Let's just have some students come along, and we had a couple rides. It was super fun. I thought, man, that would be a fun thing to do, as we have a whole lineup of all sorts of events. So,
well, this is the perfect time to pitch. We just had a mountain bike donated to the center. And if you look on the bike rack out there, it's a Trek that's maybe a little older, but it's a Trek. It's locked up.
Yeah.
And so if you want to sign up and get someone to borrow that bike.
There we go.
I think I've got another one you can for a loaner, because I don't know who comes with a mountain bike, but I got a loaner one.
That's awesome. Kind of, see, there you go. Partnership.
Partnership. This
making
is
making it happen.
That's right. Yeah.
There we go.
It's $50 to rent.
Okay. I'm going to negotiate a little bit.
No, that's it.
Awesome.
That'll be cool.
Yeah. Man.
That's great. So you're going to actually, do you have something in mind? Like just going to put the announcement out there and say, hey, meet here? And are you going to go right from campus?
I think we'll meet over Military Reserve by the foothills and go from there. But,
which I'm not sure exactly. Is that over by Camelback there?
Not quite. It's more, northeast of there. So, the hospital. That's just off to the right.
Okay.
Yep, right over there.
So they could ride over from campus and then go.
Easy. Yeah. A couple minutes to ride from campus.
Okay.
Yep.
That's a great idea.
Yeah, it'll be fun. We'll do an easy loop. And then if anyone is still ambitious after that and wants more, I'll take them on more.
Nice. That's awesome.
So,
well, it is really fun to talk to you, Billy. Yeah. Every time I see you, and you know this, I could talk to you for quite a while because yes. I'm always trying to catch up with you yeah. and everything.
But never enough time.
There never is. But we've covered some ground, some different kinds of territory. But to me, that's exactly what it's about, you know, getting to know someone. And God has been in your story the whole way through. Mm. And I'm moved, I'm motivated because I look at you and I say, you know, this is something. And I recognize, for one thing, we are totally different people. But on the other hand, there's a lot of overlap that I say, yeah, I aspire to, well, you're talking about a stressed out ADHD guy here who's always going in too many directions, you know. So I look at you and the kind of fortitude you have to pick a line and take that line and say, I'm doing this, and then you do it. That gives me a lot of inspiration, and I know other people as well. And I know when people see you on campus, it's a little bit of a lift to them, and you don't know where people are at. We were just talking about that. We have no idea what is going on. But I one time was challenged when I was volunteering with Young Life when I was in college back in Washington. If you could put a lens on or a set of goggles that showed you the spiritual reality of what's going on, you would see these skeletons walking around. Yep. And that was a powerful little metaphor or image for me that I think about. I just don't see, and I know I say this because you're the same way, you don't see these students at face value. Right. Just, oh, man, they got their act together. It's like, yeah, they might be a question and a half deep, and they don't, and they're out here looking for what is life all about. And the sad part to me is they're taking most of the assumed cues and the assumed answers to that are all taken from just media or wherever they get it. And it's the blind leading the blind. Yep. And you're somebody that offers, you have something that's a very authentic joy. And I joke about that, you know, the quote marks, the finger quotes, you know, actual ministry. Cause to me, there's all these other things, but when you're sitting across from a student and you start to see the wheels turning, and I think you're fantastic at that. And I think students they're hungry for that. So anything we can do to continue to partner together for that, I'm thrilled to do. And, thanks for sharing more of your heart and being honest and real about, you know, what took place in your life and where you're at now and where ministry is going. So just,
absolutely.
You're a good friend, and I'm thrilled to have you here today. And I'm going to reserve the right to have you here again.
Sounds good.
Do a little a little follow up. Okay.
Well, I appreciate it. And thank you so much for all the ways you bless us and so many others. I love coming down here, even just to see you. So
that's awesome.
Thanks for having me on.
We'll talk to you soon.
Sounds good.
And look forward to that when we do. Thanks, Billy. Billy Mogensen.